In this episode, I'm joined by Kingsley Dennis, who is an author, researcher, and futurist. He is the author of multiple books on modernity, control, and esotericism. In this episode, we discuss his latest book, Healing the Wounded Mind, The Psychosis of the Modern World and the Search for the Self, alongside discussions on education, society, and freedom. I'd like to thank all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this possible, and if you would like to support Emetics Podcast or become part of the community, please find links in the description below. Enjoy. Kingsley Dennis, thanks very much for joining us on Emetics Podcast.
Thank you, James. Thanks for the invite.
So we're going to be talking about your book, Healing the Wounded Mind, The Psychosis of the Modern World and the Search for the Self, which is a book for those, if I was to describe it, it's in the frame of people like Christopher Lash, John Taylor Gatto, Rampriere, John Michael Greer, books which aren't pulling any punches when it comes to the state of the world. One thing I really liked actually is that from the get-go in your book is that you don't try sort of prove your position. You know, you say, look, we all know this isn't how things should be. We all know that the world is nowhere close to how it should be in terms of freedom and in terms of how it should be with control and the individual and things along these lines. But we'll get into the book. But just before we do, just tell us a little bit about yourself and why it was you came to write Healing the Wounded Mind.
Okay, thanks. Sure. It took me a while to get where I am. And I mean, my earlier life, let's say, I did spend in academia. I was a teacher at university, first in literature, and then I moved into sociology. So I've lived abroad a number of years. I lived and taught in Istanbul, Turkey for 5 years. Then I went to Nottingham to do a course to teach in globalization. And then in the final number of years in Lancaster University in the northwest of the UK, where I did teach in sociology as well as finishing my doctorate there. And I looked, basically I was dealing with globalization and technologies of globalization, but I looked at it from the lens of complexity theory. I was using complexity theory to look at the way the world was going. And after that, I ended up my, let's say, academic career writing and publishing a book with my colleague called After the Car, looking at the post-peak oil future. And then I thought, well, you know, that's about it. That's about it for me. I don't really want to climb up the organizational ladder. And I realized that the university system was getting a bit more too commercial, client-based for me, for my liking. The funding was restricting research. The university was only interested in getting funding, particularly. I don't want to go there too much, but anyway, I decided to jump ship and go freelance. So I moved. I came to southern Spain to work on my own private publications. And I came here in 2009. So for the last 11 years, I've been a freelance writer without any ties, no funding from anyone, no obligation. And I've been writing and publishing since. And you mentioned the last book, Healing the Wounded Mind. You're right, because by the time I got to the stage of writing the book after 10 years, I think both myself and I assumed the readership had got to a certain point where you could leave some preliminaries behind, because we'd spent X years dealing with preliminaries. And I think by the time we've all arrived at this point, we can start from, you know, a bit higher up. So that's, in a nutshell, how I got to where I am.
Are you happier since beginning those 11 years?
Oh, much so. Because when I was at academia, I was publishing some essays online in private online sites, and I was getting much more feedback and interaction with readers. And then I realized that when I was publishing in university, all you were doing is just catering to your peers. And you were just kind of a bit incestuous. You were quoting each other and quoting these obscure texts that people can't even get to without a very high level financial subscription to these journals. So no one was reading them. So I thought, well, you know, what's my point? What am I here for? I wanted to be here to communicate ideas. And if you're only communicating in a little tiny incestuous family, then, you know, it defeats the object. So I'm richer. I'm poorer, but much richer, if that makes sense.
That definitely makes sense. And the university angle was one of the reasons that I never sort of went down the PhD route, stopped on my master's, but because
It's something I spoke about with a guest recently, actually, Old Biao, and he's still lecturing, and he says that it's one of the great sadnesses of studying is that the majority of papers are read by the writer, the grader, and perhaps an editor, and that's about it. And that's the reality of university life, really.
No, I'd agree with you. It is. It's a very closed environment, and you have this idea that it's very open, but it's, you know, it's open for ideas, you know, amongst a very small handful of people. And so it depends what your objective is. And if your objective is the larger field, then, you know, you may have to make a move out, as you did.
So before we jump in with the book, I have to ask you the hermetics question, which is you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
Well, I wouldn't. The people I've chosen are, I would be an odd mix because if I chose all the people I really had like favorites, then we'd all be on the same page. And I wouldn't want to listen to everybody on the same page because the conversation would be quite predictable. So the three I'll probably choose to have a common thread but a diversity would be the Georges Gurdjieff, the Armenian mystic, Carl Jung, the psychologist, and Philip K. Dick, the writer.
Gurdjieff would probably be very intense. So would Philip K. Dick. I think Jung seems to be the odd one out. But at least as I see it, but what is the thread you see running through there?
The thread would be the theme of the Gnostic understanding of life. Now, Gurdjieff would be intense, but he also has a wicked sense of humor and a way of undercutting people's argument as well and getting straight to the point. And he has this broad vision and also also, I think people have maybe not always appreciated the psychological insight of Gurdjieff, looking at what he called the three-brained mammal, the human being, you know, physical, mental, and emotional. So he was spot on, you know, right from the beginning of the century. And of course, his teachings do have a Gnostic bent because they come from the ancient, let's say, wisdom lineage. Jung, as we know, although he is well known in the orthodox psychological circles, he had a very strong interest in the occult, hermetic, and alchemical understandings, as we know from his Red Book sketches. And his Red Book sketches would be almost on a par with Dick's writings. And as we know, Dick had this revelation in 1974 where he was hit by this light and he had this Gnostic revelation that he was connected to another self in the Christian era. And he described the modern life as living in the black iron prison. And he understood that we were in a rational universe. And that rational universe was controlled by an insane god, i.e. the Gnostic deity. And he spent his remaining life writing his exegesis, which is over 1,000 pages, similar to Jung's Red Book. So I think the Gnostic element would connect them together, but they all come from a different angle. Dick was obviously the California US pop culture angle. Jung was European intellectual psychological background. And then Gurdjieff was coming out of, you know, the Russian Revolution and having his whole background to Asia and his travels there. I think you'd make a kind of a good conversation between the three.
Mm-hmm. And what would it be that you would hope to sort of find out from that conversation?
Perhaps how to get to the essence of something from totally different angles. That is, as I say, these three personages would represent different aspects of a global perspective and perceptions from different eras, different cultures and different cultural conditioning. And yet perhaps through those three eras, you could get to something which is essential, the essential of understanding the human condition from this perennial understanding of Gnosticism. So the question would be, could there be, or would it be possible to arrive at a more essential, let's say, thread running through the human condition that would be available external to life within the human bubble, that is the conditioning of different cultures.
Is that one of your sort of primary problems with the modern world then, that it seeks to constrain all alternative paths?
Yes, in some ways it is. It's what I refer to as the consensual reality. And I think that in any kind of epoch, there is, especially, you know, the culture and society you're in, always trying to create a dominant narrative, which is their view of the world, which is their consensual reality. And that's a programming which people obviously grow up with according to their institutions and all their environments. What obviously modernity is also now tied in with globalization, and there's a spread to create or enlarge these bubbles into one great homogeneous bubble. And in that sense, there's an aim to create a worldwide dominant narrative. And I think in every epoch, there's always been overarching dominant narratives. And in the past, it was a religious one. And therefore, you know, at one point going back centuries, everyone believed because they were told that we're living on a flat earth. And then they believed because they were told that, you know, the earth was the center of the universe. And it took some time before, you know, people understood that was a heliocentric model. So in every age, there's a model. And in modernity, I think it's come through the scientific, rational path, which is trying to give a dominant, overarching narrative. And then within that, you get these cultural bubbles. So at all times, even if you can break out of a cultural conditioning, the question is, can you break out of the overarching narrative, which is represents the epoch of the time?
It's interesting there that you say that the modernity is tied in with globalism. It's something I'd agree with, but to that extent, do you then find that pro-globalist politics, liberal politics, aren't really what they say they are, and they're more of a control device in the way that anything that's against them is sort of hounded as just simply incorrect as opposed to an opinion?
Yes, I mean, I don't have really a faith in politics. I think they're all a false representation to some degree. So even if people say we are the new neoliberals and we're pushing globalization and we're against the right side, etc., they're all really external fronts or facades, which are, I think, more or less playing a similar game. And although there's differences, there's tweaks, whether it's a certain form of capitalism, free market economies, etc. Behind that, yes, I think I do sense that there's an overarching kind of control mechanism. And globalization, as has been said to represent the neoliberal free market economics, etc., but really does it. Because I think you're just being given an A and a B, which is fronting an overarching, I think, agenda or narrative, which there's not much difference. So I don't have much faith in politics, and I do feel that globalization, you know, what we're told is not always, you know, what's happening. You're told that we have this freedom to choose and freedom of purchase power and the consumer power, etc. But, you know, if you look at the psychological and social elements within that, then it's anything but freedom. So I think we have to be careful with these kind of branded neoliberalisms and slogans.
It's interesting that you say the choice between A and B. So do you think that what you're aiming towards isn't actually finding this, like, a third route? Some people might say, oh, you know, there's the classic red versus blue, I'm green. You're sort of saying, how about if we take a big step back from that whole structure and look at what's going on there?
Yeah, I do. Because if you're choosing C, let's say, then you're still within the bubble of choice. You're still within the same system. You're playing it just from a slightly different angle of the same, you know, cube, A, B, C, red, blue, green. And so, no, the alternative, it's not really an alternative. It's just the illusion of choice. So I would say that the thing is, if we're choosing another option, but we're still a product of the environment and the culture that we've grown up in, and we still have these biases, then how objective is that choice? And also the question is, who is offering the choice? What's their agenda for offering the choice? And so, you know, there's that phrase from, I think, Herbert Marcuse, which said, the right to choose the masters doesn't abolish the structure of slaves and masters. So, you know, like, the facade of democracy, the ability to choose still keeps you within that system of which contains you.
One quote that comes up time and time again, and this is something that really, it's sort of, I've struggled with my writing with regards to sort of anti-modernity pieces that I've written over the years, and And it's a quote that you come back to time and time again, which is, there is a full quote, but in short, it's the root of wickedness is hidden. Now, this hidden wickedness of modernity, you know, this, what we were just talking about there, this sort of unconscious agenda, which is behind the scenes, which behind the A's and the B's, and there's something there that's saying, you should do this, you should do that. It seems to me, and I don't know if you'd agree, that people, even when this is made apparent, people cling to this out of a form of sort of comfort. They don't really like change. And this is a problem I find personally, is that who am I to say everything you're doing is wrong? There's far better ways to live. So one question here is, what right do we have to sort of say that everything is incorrect that people are doing on a social level? And two, why do you think it is that people still cling to the reality even after it has been proven time and time again to be completely false?
Well, to answer the first part of the question, what right do we have? I think we have a right to speak our truth, or free speech. So we have a right to say, well, this is my perspective. What we don't have a right to is try to force it down the throats of other people. Other people have the right to, you know, take your comment and to you know, agree, disagree, to kind of consider it or not. And, you know, I think we should get to the point where we allow everyone the free will to make that choice. I say my piece, but I don't missionize it or try to get anyone. If you have to really, really struggle to persuade people to believe it, then, you know, isn't that another form of conditioning? A person has to arrive at their own understanding and truth. A phrase that I like, a friend told me once, said that you can teach a person to ride a bike, but you can't ride it for them. And I think that's relevant here, because if a person doesn't arrive at their own truth, then it's not truly theirs. You know, if you haven't kind of paid for something from your own, you know, from your own pocket, you don't value it, do you? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, and I think people have to arrive at that. And so it's like a form of trespassing. If I try to jump on them and say, you have to believe this, then I'm trespassing on their space and their free choice. So I don't do that. So that's the answer to the first part. The answer to the second part is, you know, we have this, for example, it's easy to say that we are all fish in the sea, that we don't see the sea. And I know that an analogy has been used before, and I think it's quite correct, is that when we're in something which is all around us, it's very difficult to see it. And so, you know, I don't judge other people if they say, well, you know, I think I don't see what you're saying. I don't want this change. I don't see exactly what what this trying to say about the world. And I say, well, you know, fair enough. I remember a phrase that I learned, picked up in Turkey. It was an old kind of Arabic phrase, which I've used in my writings. And the phrase is, the bird which knows not of sweet water has his beak in salt water all the year. So, you know, if you're imbibed in the salt water, then you're not going to know that this other, you know, water exists. And it's, you know, I don't want to talk and make it sound like a kind of conspirational element. The fact is that humanity is in a kind of controlled environment. It's not new. It's been around from the very earliest days of human civilization. You can see it way back if you go to any kind of major empire. It's because it's a form of managing people, managing large numbers. If you had everyone doing exactly what they wanted, then you wouldn't have a coherent system. You wouldn't have a civilization. You wouldn't have. So, but of course, what happened is that the structure or system to try to get people working together hasn't been an organic one, hasn't been a coherent one that's respected people's rights. The other route has been taken, the route of social management, of control, and of getting people to adhere to something that they're not aware of. And I think this deliberate intent to keep people away from their self-awareness is what I find very disagreeable, and that's not organic. And I think that's what modernity is representing in the latest stage, is keeping people away from information of their own awareness, so they're kept in certain ignorance. And I think all our most institutions and structures, which I've touched on in the book about education and that, are about, you know, giving people a certain structure which they don't want people to think outside of. And so that's, I would say, answers the second part of the question. I wouldn't be judgmental about people. It's just that if people haven't arrived at a point where they can see it, the question is, how can you make people see it? And that's the question which we're probably talking about now.
Do you think then that you know, because obviously you're sort of, I'm in agreement there with that you need organization, you need structure to form a society. But the difference there is sort of, well, there's obviously multiple forms of society, but we're in the one which is covertly controlling us, as opposed to saying, this needs to be structured, here's how the structure is going to work, but you have freedom within that. Which is certain people who would argue that that happens under certain isms, but I won't get into that here. Do you think then that this sort of repressed acknowledgement of the self, which society is sort of covertly trying to not allow us to see or sense in any way, this is going to backfire at some point?
Well, I would hope so. And it is this kind of struggle between is the fully integrated human being coming to rise to the fore, to rise, or is it going to be, you know, continually constrained? And that's a point I agree with you, is that you can have a more organic self-organizing type of society with people's agreement, probably would has been operation more in the smaller communities, and the point is we have to scale that up. But we're living in a constrained, covert type of structure and agenda in society, what I've come to call the modern power machine. And that, you know, that is the issue here. And because of that, my sense is that modernity especially, but even before that, but modernity especially, because we have more psychological insight, is that it forces people to live an exterior life outside of themselves. And that has some detrimental elements to human nature. One is that means that people give their power away externally. And we can see that, that argument is framed by Stanley Milgram's Obedience to Authority, for example, which I'm sure you and your readers are aware of. So, you know, we're conditioned to give away our authority to other external elements, such as, you know, this begins at school, and then you have, you know, your peer pressure, your family, then you have institutions, legal institutions when you leave school and job, and you're always giving away your authority externally. So that really de-empowers the individual. And also that if we live an exterior life, if we're giving all our time, energy, and attention to that exterior life through, you know, distractions as well as addictions, then we're not giving time and attention to the interior life of the human being. And I think that also is what is the problem, is that unless we can kind of balance an interior life and exterior one, we are more susceptible and vulnerable to external influences and impacts.
You spend a lot of time in the book on education, and I think sort of aptly it is the clearest point where once you sort of do break out of these structures and step back and have a look at what education is doing, it's extremely clear, it's glaringly clear that control is happening. And one of my favorite theories actually is from a writer called Rand Prière. I'm not sure if you've come across him, but he has this idea that school and education when you're younger, if you look at education from the youngest as you get older and older, it slowly starts to loosen its grip. So you have, when you're really young, it's super, super controlled. You can't even go to the loo without asking, etc. And you slowly get more and more freedoms. And by the time you leave school, the idea that you can then just go off and buy a car and do what you want seems extremely free. And everything seems extremely free after school. But actually, it's just a difference of control. And, you know, this is this funny thing where people sort of begin to enjoy what they now call adulting, where people sort of take a thrill in paying taxes or filling up their car, because it's this understanding that you're no longer within the old control system, but you're still being controlled. And you state that, and I think this is from John Taylor Gatto, which is education is eternal adolescence.
Yes, and there's another phrase which I use for it, which I called, you know, arrested childhood development. And, you know, school is a kind of arrested development because, as you rightly say, you are allowed to a certain point, but those parameters shift to give you, to expand your bubble of personal identity. Those parameters are always there and very closely monitored by society, and those only allow a certain kind of move. You rightly say, as you move up the age scale, you're given a few more liberties, etc., because you need them. Otherwise, you would start to have resistive impulses too early on in life, and then that would only grow. And, you know, And they don't, I'm sure that society doesn't want those early resistive nudges to come in at a young age. So, and as you're right, and when you leave school at 16, 17, I remember when I first had my car at 17, the only thing I did, I just kept driving around, I just take it out at night, and I used to love driving at night because it was a freedom it gave me, and I wasn't going anywhere. And that's maybe a metaphor for where we are now. We're driving around, but we're only going where the roads dictate where we're going. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't go off-road unless you can afford a good off-road vehicle, but then you're in a different category. So so it's like that. And I think there is arrested development in terms of psychological maturity, because many people are still very, very highly dependent when they leave college at whatever age. And, you know, they seek a kind of workforce or career which then, you know, tells them what to do. There are very few people who leave college and then they become this kind of, you know, entrepreneur, freewheeling, and then they start being the master of themselves. These are Gatto did a survey looking at how many people, very famous entrepreneurs who made their money, maybe what society would call mavericks, mm-hmm. people outside the system. And something like virtually 90% or more of these mavericks dropped out of school. Mm-hmm. You know? And so how many mavericks actually went through the whole educational system and came out of university in 21? Not many. And so because I think there is this arrested development of psychological maturity because you've been used to a certain obedience. Imagine, it's especially worse in the US school system where you need a what they call a hall pass, what we would call a corridor pass, to step out to even go to the toilet. And then, there are often guards in the corridor and everything is just like a work camp and it's just heavily guarded. And so you feel that you can't go it alone. You need some support system, which is deliberate. And so I think that's all part of this arrested development, and psychologically and also with critical thinking. And Gatto pointed out, which I put in the book, is that a lot of those reports from so-called educationalists, they more or less deliberately said that they want to lower down critical thinking. Because if there's too many critical thinking, they can't maintain the quota for the workforce. So it's all there if you can find the information, but it's not hard to disagree with either.
There's something else that you mentioned just a bit back, which is actually from, I think, I wonder if you took it from Gurdjieff, actually. And this idea, you were saying that with regards to not being, you can teach someone to ride a bike, but you can't ride it for them. And this idea that you need to pay for knowledge in some form, whether it's monetary, whether it's your own time or your own stress and effort. Gurdjieff made this clear, actually. He said no one will respect any knowledge which is given to them. And I think maybe this is one of the problems with modern education, is that it's not even given to you. It's a priori. It's default. And in this way that no one really ever really learns, because as Ivan Illich says, the process of learning is now mistaken for the substance. So it's like you're not actually learning, but you believe you are because this is what they now call learning. But you're not really learning anything. You know, I think there's a recent sort of study about people who, what they've actually used since high school. And when people think about it, it is, you don't really use anything unless you specify into it. And it, just this idea of paying for knowledge, obviously, I just think it's an interesting idea with respect to what's going on in modernity and not questioning things which are given to you for free, basically.
It is, and you're right. I mean, I remember an incident whereby, I didn't enjoy my maths class when I was at college, and I remember when I was doing my sines and cosines, I can't remember them now, but I asked the teacher, why are we learning sines and cosines? And the teacher looked at me and said, I remember his answer, he said, well, wouldn't you, for example, when you place a ladder against a wall, like to calculate the angle of the ladder? Mm-hmm. And I just blankly look back thinking, if I'm going to climb a ladder, I want to hold on tight, not to fall. I couldn't care less what the angle is. It's common sense what the angle is. If you either put a ladder up too steep or not. So from that day, I mean, I kind of thought, what are we really learning this stuff for? About payment, it's kind of gone the other way around, because yes, we kind of accept a thing to be put on a plate to us, and we kind of expected that to happen because we thought, well, we have a right to be, given this stuff. And now we've become a kind of client base. And this was very evident in university because we, as you're aware of, the grants for university have now been kind of erased, and students are paying very heavily, and they become clients. And when for example, I had to give some students failures because they're not handing their essays in, I was told that you have to keep allowing them a second chance, a third chance, a fourth chance, because they have to pass because their parents are paying a lot of money, and they want to know why their child hasn't passed. So you realize they're not students anymore; they're paying clients. And so if they're paying, they're expecting to be a product. They're expecting them to be delivered a product, whether it's given to them or they are the product. And this is spilled over as well into, let's say, wisdom teaching, since we're talking about Gurdjieff, that this is very much the kind of modern guruism. And as I call Guru Avenue and Ashram Avenue and Guru Boulevard land, is that if you pay a guru a lot of money, as they especially do in LA, then you expect certain knowledge to be given to you because you've paid monetary for it. But you haven't paid in your own internal work or your own development to arrive at it. So, we've been turned around from thinking we should be given everything because we just have a right to it, to the point of, well, now we're participating because we pay for it, we have a right for it. But it's still missing the point, isn't it?
Yeah, the commodification of mindfulness meditation, something I always joke about, the idea that they finally found a way to commodify sitting and being, which is sort of astounding. But as you say, I mean, I think this sort of new age Silicon Valley pseudo-Eastern mysticism that seems to be arising, the irony of mindfulness meditation being taught in corporations is that mindfulness meditation is the one which allows you to be able to deal with greater stress. It's not the one which teaches you to think, which is mantra meditation. I don't think they'll ever be paying for their workforce to think, to partake in that.
And just to end on that, again, there's the rise, even academia is trying to get into this with a so-called course on positive psychology. Now, I mean, I'm not against the concept per se, but of course, it's how you do it. If anyone's interested, I made a video, an actual kind of voice singing video called Pop Spirit, which is looking at this the commercialization of pseudo pop spirituality, and you actually see me on the video with the face of a cat, so it's worth watching. So if you put me in YouTube, my name and Pop Spirit, you get this my take on modern popular commercial guruism.
Have you ever sort of been part of a spiritual group such as the Fourth Way or anything along these lines?
I was partly with the Fourth Way, yes. When I was actually living and teaching in Prague, that was I was in my mid-20s before I went to Turkey. I was with a Gurdjieff Fourth Way group in Prague at that time. And I've been reading Gurdjieff for many, many years also. So, yes, I've had touches with them.
One other thing that you bring up early on in the book is this idea that, and it sort of ties into what we were saying about this just being given things, is the idea of waiting for something to happen. And it sort of ties into what you were just saying there. It's the idea that you give money to, as the example we gave there, a mindfulness or a meditation course, and you're then sort of waiting. You don't have to put in the effort. You're just waiting for something to come along because you've partaked in the way that society expects. And it seems like a big global waiting for Godot. Do you think this is a way to keep people docile in that, the idea of if you don't investigate yourself, then you're not going to understand that things don't just come along and arise. Mm.
Yes, and I think it goes back to what we were saying a little bit earlier about the exteriorization of life, is that if people are being conditioned to live externally, then, from that perspective, then everything which comes or everything which happens is just an external element. And so therefore life happens to them while they're living. That's a kind of external mentality, isn't it? You're just in life, and life will happen around you. It'll come to you, and you deal with it when it comes. That phrase, I'll deal with it when it comes, rather than kind of meeting it. I have a I have a kind of image which I think about, and I say, well, you know, if you want to catch a train, if you go to a train station and you're waiting on the bench on the platform, the train comes, you know, unless you get your ass off the bench and walk into the, you know, get to the train, open the door and get in, you won't actually get on the train. If you stay on the bench, the train is going to leave without you. So you have to participate. You have to meet it somewhere, don't you? And so I think that it's the element whereby, because people are conditioned, we all are conditioned, you know, that life happens externally, then it's a sense that therefore we don't have any participation. We don't have a responsibility to manifest some of the life for us or to participate. We are just, you know, waiting for, like, bobbing up and down like corks on the sea to see what comes to us. Well, that's not my perspective. And I say that I think that's what keeps people docile. If we have an understanding that life is a co-participatory event, that it's flowing through us all the time, we're inimically, inherently a part of the flows of life, and how we respond will then react to how the flows respond outside. There's, you know, we are mutually interchangeable. We're porous with life. The body is porous. We're not just a separate island in the sea of life, which again is a you know, the scientific, rationalist, modernic understanding. We are these separate islands. We're not. This is my understanding. We are not. We are porous, intelligent, sentient beings which are flowing with the flow of life, and we have to participate. And by participating, we have responsibility to meet life halfway. And if, you know, and if we don't, then we will be docile and we will be susceptible to external impacts that socially manages.
So would you define the psychosis then, the mass and individual psychosis of the modern world, as something which sort of wraps up the individual and blocks up all that porous potentiality to connect? It just sort of keeps you in a straitjacket.
Well, the thing about psychosis is that, you know, individually and collectively, I think, you know, again, part of the modern conditioning is that the individual is separate and not a part of, or not so much interacting with the collective. And that's not my understanding, is that the individual and the collective are interflowing between each other. You know, one is in the other and the collective is in the individual and vice versa. So, you know, people say, okay, the world's going mad, but doesn't, you know, nothing to do with me. Well, if you're being affected by what's happening in the world, you maybe not realize that that's unconsciously working through you and that they may project through you. You may not know that if you have a bad day, or if you have an argument with someone, or you're ratty and, you know, irritable with someone, or even slightly violent with someone, you may just think that you had an off day, but, you know, you may not realize that you are also kind of receiving what's going on in the world through the news, through impacts, through, you know, in many unconscious ways. So if there is a collective psychosis, then we have to be aware of that. If there is a ill mental feeling going through the world, because we are susceptible to that. And again, vice versa. If we are not feeling right in ourselves, and if we have an anger inside of us or an imbalance, then that actually, you know, that filters out to those around us. And it's, you know, people think this is kind of woo-woo voodoo stuff, but it's not. It's quite common sense. And we do understand this at heart, I feel. We just don't have the vocabulary or the context to frame it, or we don't wish to. But for example, if you walk into a room, you know very well, you get, oh, I've got a bad vibe here, I don't feel right, you know, there's something wrong. You know, we pick it up, but we tend to either say, oh, it's nothing, or we think it's just, you know, whatever, something else, it's just a one-off. But if you listen to your gut feelings, your own, like you say, reaction to this feeling, whether there's good energy or bad energy, then we see that we're interacting on ways that we're not external to us, but is rather internal, these flows. So I think really we just have to accept and acknowledge this, and we have to own up to it, that it's okay to talk about this, that we're not being weird if we're talking about having internal reaction to these energies outside of us. And that's what I feel modernity tries to cut us off from, this understanding, and tries to make us embarrassed about talking about an interior life that interacts externally with the world around us.
So for you, it isn't so much, the psychosis isn't so much born in an event as it's more it's formed, you know, because we're born into it physically, but it's regarding our social upbringing, whether or not we are going to partake in it. And I guess for most people they are, because they're funnel through the school system, which teaches it's this rationalist operation.
Yes, I mean, for me, like, my understanding of psychosis, or, you know, one perspective of psychosis, is that it's an imbalanced view, perception of reality. We have an incoherent or a bit of a topsy-turvy perception of reality, and that can be seen as a psychosis. And so this, as you rightly say, is something which is conditioned into our society, the certain consensus narrative that this is reality. But if it's slightly wrong, and we sense it's slightly wrong, but we buy into it, then that can start to have a psychosis. As you mentioned at the beginning of this program, when I opened the book with the message that we all know that something's slightly wrong, you know, as Bob Dylan sang in the 60s, there's something going on here, Mr. Jones, you know. So there's something going on here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? And we sense there's something going on. But because this sense of what's going on doesn't align with the consensual general narrative, then we have this kind of incongruency, which I think creates a psychosis. And I think that's happening in the world right now to a great degree, is that a lot of systems in the world are becoming dysfunctional. A lot of things are breaking down. We've got these false news, fake news. Everyone is lying through their teeth. Things just don't seem right. And things are going askew. And that means that this consensus narrative, which everyone invested in and believed in and accepted, it's like, whoa, there's something going on here, and I don't feel right because my sense of reality is not kind of adjusting. That's creating, I think, a collective psychosis, which we've seen pouring out into the streets quite literally around the world. And that, again, affects individually. So I think there's something of this going on at the moment.
So the million-dollar question, obviously, as a sociologist, I'm sure there was certain research on this as well, but how do you break out of the psychosis? And do the traditional clinical methods of how it's advised to break out of a psychosis, do they work, or are they part of the system as well?
Well, I'll answer your second question first. I wouldn't personally put any trust in the clinical psychology. I'm not an expert on clinical psychology. So, as I say in the pharmaceutical adverts, don't beware of what's on the packaging. So beware what I say, but I would not trust it because I would say it's part of the system. And if you want more information on that, then I would say, at least read Michel Foucault. He did a very good, as you know, investigation of the disciplinary power of the medical health paradigm. So no, I would say because most of the understanding of the medical paradigm is based on orthodox understanding, which has come through our institutions. I would say, well, first off, I would say we have to get hold of different ways of information and knowledge. And I remember Robert Anton Wilson, the writer, especially in the 70s and 80s, he used to say, if you want to learn something, always read the material from the people you disagree with, the alternative material. So start to get alternative views. And I think this is also what Philip K. Dick puts forward. He says that we're living in a black eye in prison. And so the first step is to realize that we're living in a prison because, as the adage says, if you don't see the bars, then you don't realize you're in a prison. So I think to see the bars, we have to step outside of mainstream orthodox channels of information. It's information that we need to educate ourselves. And so what I think we need to get out of, you say, this psychosis, a million-dollar question, is that we have to enter our own process of deconditioning because no one's going to do it for you. Of course, all the life systems and institutions, it's there in their vested interest to maintain that conditioning. So no one's going to do it for you. So if you want to start to step away, then you have to do it yourself. Find information. Look for alternative sources. People have done it. People have done it over ages. Read books from people that you, like you say, tweak your interest. And once you start to change your perception from the main narrative, you'll find how so many different perspectives come into view. It's as if we believe that to move out of the psychosis, we have to leap, 20 yards. We have to make a big jump. But it's not so. Just a tiny, tiny tweak of your perception and your perspective will open up grand vistas. It's that, you know, it's that close to you. Doris Lessing, the English writer, did a wonderful radio series of essays, which she published as a very thin book, about 80 pages, and it's called The Prisons We Choose to Live Inside. So I would say to the reader, go and start with that, The Prisons We Choose to Live Inside, and then, you know, and then trail off and find other information and try to work on your own deconditioning until you can see the bars.
And do you, as someone who clearly draws a lot of experience from an understanding from occultism, do you think that our understanding of death and suffering is important in this process? Because this for me is one of the big questions, because it's something that modernity really constrains and sort of makes the absolute most hostile element of the universe is death. It's almost like an incorrect point as opposed to a fact. Do you think that plays a key role?
I would, yes. You know, this modernity in the current paradigm is more dead than death itself. And the reason, as you say, death is so important is that we live in fear of death most of our life. And so, therefore, we're living life in fear. And we kind of have this conditioning that we are living to die. And so how is that going to change your life? It's an incredible attractor. You know, you cannot get a kind of a larger attractor. Attractor is obviously something which pulls in everything else around you and kind of molds your life around. So we have this attractor that, you know, we're all going to die. It's inevitable. And we're living just to die. And so whether we're thinking of it consciously, it's always in the back of our mind. And I think part of that actually goes back much, much further. It goes back to basically the most central paradigm of all human existence is that why are we here? And the orthodox narrative, which is one of, is that we are just the accidental product of some sulfuric pools of microbial life that happened to be, you know, formed on a dead rock, which is hurtling through empty space. Now, you know, therefore, if that's your view of life, then you know, it's pretty grim. And how can that psychologically give a sense of purpose? If that is, we are only going to live X years, let's say 80 years, which is an average lifespan in a modern kind of industrialized country. If we live 80 years because we're just an accident product and then we're going to die and that's it, then if that's framing your life, I think it's going to curtail your life. It's going to not allow us to seek a more adventurous understanding of ourselves. So I think we have to switch around completely, 180 degrees, this understanding of life. For me, we are living in a vibrant, conscious, cosmic, intelligent, universal field, and life is continuous. And again, some viewers may think that I'm going into a different sphere here, but this is completely compatible with a normal sociological perspective as well. It's not one side of life and another. And you mentioned the occult. And again, cult has a bad rap in modern times. People think it's some kind of dark, demonic person wearing a black robe doing some sacrificial ritual. You know, the occult just simply means it was hidden, non-visible information. And the earliest wisdom schools were seen as occult because they knew they had wisdom, which was dangerous to for everybody to have if they hadn't done some preparation. It was simply that. People had to be prepared. And this occult knowledge, I think, was the basis of all our sciences. As you know, modern science came from alchemical science, which came from further back occult understanding. Psychology today, if you go back into some of these earlier occult traditions, they had very, very highly advanced psychological understanding. So psychology today is a kind of descendant of that. And all this lineage tells us that we are not an accident on a dead rock in empty space. We are part of a much larger stream, a living wisdom stream, a living intelligence. So I think, yes, if we are entrapped in this tiny bubble of we're going to die, then it's going to completely overrule our sense of purpose and fulfillment. And that is what modernity, I think, has increased. It's cut us off. It's sprinted our connection with this living sense of an adventurous, purposeful life, James.
Is there anything you'd like to add about the book, or something that we've glossed over that you'd like to mention?
Well, I'd like to say that the book is in three parts, and we've touched more on, I think, the second part about modernity. The first part, they are more, let's say, references to other traditions, such as shamanism, Don Juan, and Rudolf Steiner, as well as Jung. And so it puts it in the context. And the third section is more about our own path to self-gnosis, self-understanding. So, I mean, my perspective is, as you rightly say, I think we have a responsibility to speak our truth and to say what are the inhibiting factors in life and what are the perhaps negative influences on us, but purely as a means, as a bridge to get to the next part, which is we can therefore empower ourselves, and we have a duty to empower ourselves to be a fully human being, so we take autonomy into our lives. And whatever I write about, the final point is always that, that we have our own autonomy and freedom, and we are a sovereign being.
But then we get caught with the problem of you can lead a horse to water, but you can't force it to drink. So it's one of the problems with people often ask me, I've read a lot of occult stuff and done various things over the times, and people ask me where to start and what to do, and I say, well, I can tell you what to read, but the journey's yours. There's nothing I can do once you start. That's the big problem. Is how you escape it is probably going to be extremely subjective. There's no, I don't think there's ever going to be a 10-step program to enlightenment.
no way. And, you know, going back to, I think it was Rumi, a Persian poet, said there are many ways to climb a mountain, but the view at the top is the same. And so you have to choose your own route. As you say, there's no, and that's another way perhaps of recognizing, distinguishing some of the pseudo paths, is when they say there's only this one route to get where you need to go. And, you know, there's no one size doesn't fit all. You know, going to a clothing store, you find one size doesn't fit all. And it's the same with self-development. And just to finish off, if I may, James, I've just put out a book. I self-published it myself, so I had complete control over it. It only came out a couple of weeks ago, and it's called The Modern Seeker, Perennial Psychology for Contemporary Times. And what I've tried to do is exactly what we're speaking about, trying to put today's modern world into a context of a perennial path, which has always existed, but it existed in modern – it's applicable for modern times. I'm only saying that, but as I say, everyone has to, you know, take their choice and run with it. And I wish everyone the very best with their own decisions. And don't let anyone make decisions for you.
Whereabouts can we find The Modern Seeker?
It's available online. So if you do Google it online, you'll find it. And, you know, of course, the major seller is Amazon these days. But saying that, I have over 50 essays on my website, which are all downloadable and readable at your leisure. If you just Google my name, Kingsley Dennis, my website is kingsleydennis.com. If you go onto there, there's a menu called Writings. And under that Writings menu is a list called Essays. And there's over 50 essays I've been writing, or 60 or 70 I've been writing the last 10 years. So take your pick, and they're all there for anyone's leisure.
Okay. I'll be sure to link that in the description below. But Kingsley Dennis, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, James. Been a great pleasure.